You're tuned to WFHB.
Volunteer powered,
listener supported.
Community radio for South Central Indiana.
Good afternoon. Reporting remotely for WFHB, this is Benedict Jones.
And I'm Cade Young. This is the WFHB local news for Thursday, June 3rd, 2021.
Later in the program, WFHB correspondent Robert Robinson spoke with Thomas Alcamo, the EPA's remedial project manager, about the EPA's latest announcement that it will remove three Bloomington area Superfund sites from its national priorities list. More coming up in today's feature reports.
Also coming up in the next half hour, we have coverage from last night's meeting of the Bloomington City Council. More coming up in today's headlines. But first, your local news brief.
From WFHB, this is the local news brief for Thursday, June 3rd. I'm Katrine Bruner. According to the Indiana State Department of Health COVID-19 dashboard, the state has had 418 new positive cases and 20 new deaths in the last 30 days. Monroe County has had one death from COVID-19 over the last 2 weeks. Test positivity rate is at 3% currently, and 40% of the county is fully vaccinated. The New York Times summarized that Monroe County cases have decreased in recent weeks, but are still high. There is an average of about 6 cases per day, which is 42% less than the average 2 weeks ago. Indiana University released a health and safety guide on Tuesday explaining how the campus will be running from August 1st to December 31st. COVID-19 restrictions will be gone for the most part during the fall 2021 semester, including masks and physical distancing on campus. Classes and regular settings like dining halls and fitness centers will be open to students and return to regular capacity limits, according to IU's Restart Committee. Public spaces and common surfaces will continue to be cleaned and disinfected regularly. As for now, events with more than 250 people will have to go through a review process, and large indoor events with non-IU attendees will require masks on. Students and staff who are not fully vaccinated will have to wear a mask on campus and participate in testing. If anyone tests positive for the virus, they will need to isolate themselves for 10 days or until symptoms improve and stay improved for at least 24 hours. The Bloomington Garden Club is hosting a summer garden walk this weekend. The walk will be available on Saturday and Sunday, both from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. Tickets are $10 and free for kids ages 12 and younger. They can be purchased at both Blooming Foods locations, Bloomington Hardware, Bloomington Valley Nursery, Ellettsville True Value Hardware, Goods for Cooks, Hall's Greenhouse, or May's Greenhouse. That's all for your local news brief. For WFHB, I'm Katrine Bruner.
At the June 2nd Bloomington City Council meeting, council members discussed creating a form that confirms how many non-related adults live in small rental properties. Director of Housing and Neighborhood Development John Zodi presented a resolution that would require landlords to present an affidavit for their tenants to sign. He said the form would help replace previous forms that the city can no longer require.
We can no longer require the rights and responsibilities pamphlet, brochure, form, as you know. That rights and responsibilities document did have in it an affidavit, if you will. It was affirming that the tenant had reviewed the occupancy permit for the unit, and then all the tenants had signed that. That is no longer allowed to be distributed under state law. So this affidavit could be considered an extrapolation of that, which is allowed. So it doesn't, we don't believe this impacts the tenant landlord relationship in telling them what their rights or responsibilities are, et cetera. But it does, we do believe this is allowable under the law to ask for this affidavit.
Zodi clarified the affidavit would only need to be filed each year if a property had new residents. Councilmember Isabel Piedmont-Smith presented an amendment that would require the affidavit be signed annually, even if the residents haven't changed. She said this would help educate residents on occupancy limits.
It's a good reminder to people, even if, you know, they've done it a year ago. It's good to remind them that, hey, there's a reason that only you three people are on the lease, and to affirm that with a signature, I think has value in, you know, conveying that message.
Resident Greg Alexander opposed the amendment. He said the extra step would just punish multi-year tenants.
It's not uncommon for a lease to automatically renew without anything new being signed every year. That is actually the arrangement that I have with my tenant. It would be another pointless interaction with my tenant for me to do this. Exactly like Mr. Zodi said, it's just we shouldn't penalize multi-year tenants.
The amendment passed 5-4 with council members Dave Rollo, Kate Rosenbarger, Matt Flaherty, and Susan Sandberg dissenting. Councilmember Ron Smith suggested the resolution be moved to a future council meeting for further discussion. Council members voted to postpone the resolution to June 16th regular session unanimously.
The Monroe County Board of Zoning Appeals discussed variances at a property on East Hardin Ridge Road. At the June 2nd meeting, senior planner Tammy Bierman presented a request that would allow the petitioner to build a pool on their property. She said planning staff still recommended denial based on the pool's proposed location.
Staff had made the recommendation to deny all three because basically with finding C, that we feel like there's other locations that this pool could be located to that the construction would not encroach into that 125-foot lake setback.
Petitioner Keith Dickerson realized he would be installing a retaining wall before beginning construction on the pool. He said this would help prevent erosion and keep the pool the required 120 feet away from Lake Monroe.
That pool will actually not be built until October. What will happen this summer is the retaining wall will be built months before the pool goes in. So the wall facing the lake and the wall that abuts the 125-foot setback, that retaining wall will be put in with the mini excavator. So what will happen is an 18-foot bucket will be put in, that wall will be put in. Therefore, it will be impossible when they come in to put the pool in, there will already be a retaining wall barrier, so nothing can get over the retaining wall and erode anything.
Board member Bernie Garitas motioned to approve the variances with the same conditions proposed at the May 5th meeting. Board members voted 4-1, with Margaret Clements dissenting.
Now it's time for your feature reports. Up first, WFHB correspondent Robert Robinson spoke with Thomas Alcamo, the EPA's remedial project manager, about the EPA's latest announcement that it will remove three Bloomington area Superfund sites from its national priorities list. We turn to Robert Robinson for more.
After decades of remediation, the EPA recently announced the removal of three Bloomington area Superfund sites from its national priorities list. In the 1960s, Westinghouse Electric Corporation, now Viacom CBS, dumped PCB-contaminated waste in Lemon Lane Landfill, Neal's Landfill, and Bennett's Dump, all located in the Bloomington area. The contamination was discovered in the 1970s, and the waste sites have been under remediation since 1985. Now that the contaminants have been reduced to target levels, the sites will be removed from the national priorities list. They will continue to be maintained by Viacom CBS under the supervision of the EPA in accordance with the same requirements as before. I spoke with Thomas Alcamo, the EPA's remedial project manager for the Bloomington sites, who stressed the EPA's ongoing commitment to the remediation.
There's no difference before delisting and after delisting. EPA is their monitoring site. Every 5 years, EPA will be doing five-year reviews to evaluate the protectiveness of the remedy. For example, we have monitoring programs in place at all the sites that we get and evaluate the data. So in any case, if we do see something unusual or something that is causing an unacceptable risk, we have the ability to reopen the site remedy and address any of those concerns. And many of these sites, for example, these sites, the water treatment systems are going to run for years and years and years. And so it shows the community that we've made progress in addressing the site risks at the site, but we still have to stay on top of doing monitoring and the company still has to do all the necessary maintenance. So it's not a type of walk away type remedy. So I wouldn't call it a bureaucratic exercise. It's more of a milestone that we like to show progress to the community that, you know, we've implemented all the construction activities. And also we have met the remedial action objectives.
When I asked Alcamo if Viacom CBS would remain responsible for the site, and if they would be liable in the event of a recontamination, his response on both counts was emphatic.
Yes and yes. Yes, they are still a responsible party that is performing all the operation and maintenance, and performing all the monitoring. They have hired consultants. They have an office down in Bloomington, and so they're there for the long term. And I think myself and the rest of the government are very pleased to date how they've maintained all the site remedies, and they continue to do they need to do to ensure that the remedy is protective of public health and the environment at all three sites.
In the 1960s, PCBs were used frequently in electrical equipment for their chemical stability. However, after being linked to a wide range of skin conditions and cancers, they were banned under U.S. federal law in 1978. Westinghouse was one such user of PCBs. Before changing its name to CBS Corporation in 1995 and subsequently being acquired by Viacom in 1999, Westinghouse was a major producer of electrical capacitors with a factory located in Bloomington. Throughout the 1960s and 70s, the factory dumped large amounts of faulty capacitors and other PCB-contaminated waste at Lemon Lane Landfill, Neal's Landfill, and Bennett's Dump. In the late 1970s, harmful PCB concentrations were discovered in streams, sediment, and wildlife around the sites. Chemicals at the dumps had trickled into the groundwater and seeped through Bloomington's porous underground karst topography into nearby water systems. In particular, Clear Creek, Canard's Branch, and Stouts Creek were each contaminated with dangerous levels of PCB. In 1981 and 1983, state and federal governments filed lawsuits, and the sites were placed on the EPA's National Priorities List, or, in common parlance, made Superfund sites. After a protracted legal battle, a consent decree agreement was reached in 1985. Viacom CBS, formerly Westinghouse, agreed to fund a cleanup of the sites. The initial consent decree required the construction of a hazardous waste incinerator to dispose of the PCB-contaminated material, but the proposal was met with widespread popular opposition. After further deliberations over how to clean up the sites, operating principles were reached in 1994. Then, following delays in implementation, further consent decrees were reached in the late 90s. The measures in these agreements were fully carried out in 2000. At each of the three sites, large amounts of contaminated soil were excavated. Thousands of capacitors were removed and disposed of out of state, and landfill caps were installed, layers of sediment designed to prevent human and animal contact with the PCBs. Water treatment plants were also installed at each location. In 2009, the consent decree was amended to address contamination in nearby streams and sediment. Viacom CBS agreed to expand the water treatment plants and implement additional measures aimed at remediating soil quality. Viacom CBS also agreed to indefinitely take over maintenance of the water treatment plants and continue testing fish tissue and water for PCB contamination. According to Alcamo, the goals of these consent decrees have been met.
We've implemented all the remedies at all three sites. We've excavated, if you're looking at a 2009 document, we implemented all those remedies that were listed in that consent decree amendment between, 2010, 11, 12, we finished up some stuff at Bennett's Dump in 2017, actually, the construction of the water treatment plant. So, no, we've done what we're supposed to do with respect to excavations. And for example, at Bennett's Dump, we excavated that site to a commercial cleanup standard for the landfills. We have a landfill cap over these sites. We did do large-scale excavation at the actual landfills. 8,000 tons at Lemon Lane Landfill and 40,000 tons at Neal's Landfill. And then we put cap material over that remaining material, and then that cap is maintained.
Additionally, the contaminated streams, Clear Creek, Kennards Branch, and Stouts Creek, have shown significant reductions in PCB concentration.
We've made a point to try to focus on reducing the PCB levels. For example, at Clear Creek, depending upon the species, in Clear Creek, it was always a do not eat. Now we're, and the worst case is 1 meal a month. So we have made progress, and I think as we continue to treat water, I think over time we're going to, it'll improve over time. So in any case, you know, these are persistent compounds are hard to address. You know, all across the country, we have sites that have PCBs that they just are, you know, they were made to be persistent, these chemicals, and they're definitely difficult to deal with.
Environmental remediation is an indefinite, lengthy process. And above all else, Alcamo emphasized the EPA's intent to see it through.
I think EPA plans to be in the Bloomington community many, many, many years, make sure that these remedies remain protective of public health and the environment.
Though the sites are no longer on the national priorities list, the requirements imposed by the 2009 consent decree amendment are unchanged. Officials have opened a 30-day public comment period that runs until June 14th, during which residents with questions or concerns about the removal of these sites from the list may submit comments on the EPA's website. For WFHB, I'm Robert Robinson.
Last Friday, Indiana University officials suggested they had no intention to back down from requiring students, faculty, and staff to have finished their COVID-19 vaccinations before they can attend or work during the 2021 fall semester. Then Indiana University announced on Tuesday that it will modify its COVID-19 vaccine mandate, making it optional for students, faculty, and staff to show proof of vaccination. The decision came in the aftermath of criticism after university officials said IU will require vaccination for the 2021 fall semester. While the vaccine is still mandatory for the upcoming school year, returning students and employees will have to verify their vaccination status in an online form rather than uploading documentation directly. Chuck Carney, media spokesperson for Indiana University, discussed what led to the decision to modify the COVID-19 vaccine mandate.
Well, we had a lot of feedback, as you probably heard, from students, parents, faculty, and staff, and a lot of conversations with legislative leaders. And that prompted us to make an adjustment in the policy. But it's important to note that we still require the COVID-19 vaccine. And it is still something that that everybody is going to need to have, faculty, students, and staff. So that is unchanged. What we have changed is the process for reporting that. So you don't have to upload the documentation. There will be an attestation form. However, we also are providing incentives for those who want to upload their information, so that there will be a way that they can do that if they would like to. The details and those incentives for that will be coming out later this week.
Carney said there will be exemptions for the vaccine requirement, but he made it clear that those exemptions will be narrow.
There's the standard religious exemption, which is by Indiana state law, and we've had that in there throughout. And by the way, the exemptions have been something we announced at the very start of this, with that there would be exemptions. They will be narrow, but we do have them. There are also medical exemptions that providing documentation from a healthcare provider, and that could include an allergy to COVID-19 vaccines or those components, and medical deferrals, which might be somebody who's immunocompromised, or if you are currently pregnant and you're requesting an exemption. And those are things that that you would also need to have a note from a healthcare provider. The only other one is someone who is in an online program with no on-campus component, and that is somebody who is not going to be on any of our campuses ever, then they could get an exemption as well. But that would be a fairly narrow group of people. And the goal here is, of course, to make sure that we're all safe and healthy. And so we think that the primary thing is for most people to get vaccinated. And that's what we hope most people will do. And we don't expect to have a ton of exemptions.
In the university's updated health and safety guidelines, most restrictions on mask wearing and physical distancing will be lifted. According to the guidelines, due to uncertainty with variants, the duration of immunity, and seasonal reoccurrence, the university will continue to monitor and update its policies. Carney touched on some highlights of the new changes according to the university's updated health and safety guidelines.
Well, the primary thing is if you're fully vaccinated, then you don't have to wear a mask indoors and you don't have to physically distance from others. So that's a big incentive. So in returning to a more normal campus life, that's the thing that will get us there, getting vaccinated, and then you don't have to wear the mask and you don't have to physically distance. If you do have an exemption, you will have to mask and you will have to physically distance, and you're going to undergo more testing than the rest of the population. There will be largely no testing for most people that are vaccinated. There will be some surveillance testing just to make sure that we're keeping a handle on things, but for the most part, there will be nothing like the mitigation testing that we did last year, which required some students to come in as much as 2 times a week. That won't exist for people who are fully vaccinated. So that's the biggest change in how the campus will look and feel this year, in that everybody who's vaccinated can return largely to normal settings, including large classroom settings and dining spaces. Those will all be back open with no mask wearing and no physical distancing. So the hope is to return to more normal operations. The vaccine is the way that we get through the virus and get there.
Again, Carney mentioned that IU's most recent guidelines for the fall semester stemmed from critical feedback from students and parents and even the state's attorney general and a handful of GOP lawmakers. Carney described how he felt about the criticism towards the university for requiring vaccines for students and employees.
Well, these are difficult decisions, and it's not like we can look back to 20 years ago and see what we did in the COVID pandemic of 19, you know, whatever. It's simply something that, as we've heard so many times throughout this, it's unprecedented. So we've all had to make very difficult decisions. At Indiana University, the health and safety of our students, faculty, and staff has been first and foremost in driving those decisions. It's why we are ahead of most everybody else in testing. We built our own testing labs, 3 of them. That's something that I don't know that any other university has done. It allowed us to ramp up testing at a rate much higher than in the rest of the state, and allowed us to keep the positivity rate for COVID at really, really low levels for most of the year. So we understand that there are strong feelings about the pandemic, the causes, the vaccine itself, and we expected that there would be strong reactions on any number of sides regarding this. But our job at the end is to protect our students, faculty, and staff, and our leadership has made the decision to require the vaccine to make sure that we are as safe as we can possibly be. We know that people have questions about the vaccine, but the one thing that's unquestionable is it is far worse to get COVID than any particular questions that there may be about the vaccine at this point. And we think that the vaccine has been proven safe, and the way to remain healthy and keep away from COVID.
Carney clarified that even though there are changes to the proof of vaccination policy, vaccines are still required to return for the fall semester. He said that he hopes the vaccine mandate will lead to a return to normal.
That's the way that we get back to normal. If we want to have a full football stadium to see maybe the best football team that IU's ever had, then that's the way we do it. If we want to get back to Assembly Hall to see basketball, that's the way that we do it. If we want to just simply have everybody in person for classes, vaccines are going to be necessary. And it is, to this point, proven that it's pushing down the infection rate where people are vaccinated. So this is the way forward for us, and we're going to continue to push and require that vaccine and make sure that our students, faculty, and staff are indeed safe on our IU campuses.
To view IU's updated health and safety guidance for the upcoming semester, visit wfhb.org following this broadcast.
You've been listening to the WFHB Local News. Today's headlines were written by Katrine Bruner and Jake Jacobson in partnership with CATS, Community Access Television Services. Our engineer and executive producer is Cade Young.
Our feature was produced by Robert Robinson. Our theme music is provided by Mark Bingham and the Social Climbers. For WFHB, I'm Cade Young.
And I'm Benedict Jones. Thanks for supporting Indiana's only volunteer-powered, listener-supported, independent daily news program. You can hear tonight's full broadcast, as well as all other WFHB news programming online at WFHB.org.
You can be a part of our award-winning news team. For more information about joining our volunteer team of citizen journalists, email news@WFHB.org.
Stay tuned for Big Talk with Michael Glad, coming up next on WFHB.
Listening to the WFHB Local News on WFHB Community Radio. Our news is written and reported by volunteers working to provide local news, cover local issues, and strengthen our local community. We invite you to participate. You may submit questions, comments, and story ideas to news@wfhb.org. You can become a WFHB Local News volunteer by attending new volunteer orientation. Feel free to check out the WFHB Local News Archive at WFHB.org to find newscasts, individual stories, and catch a live feed of the WFHB Local News. We are local, longer,